are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
John Lester can lace a double off him. All hope is lost.
Yeah, he walked Lester twice, maybe, I think. Yeah, he got absolutely crushed by
it. We are friends with Fantasy Benefits. Now that I know that Matt Thompson gives him his endorsement, that kind of scares me off. Matt Thompson thinks Magnanimous Sierra, whatever the fuck his name is in St. Louis, is like going to be Mike Trout.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
I will give up my firstborn to have Tim Anderson's walk rate at 7.7%.
Wow.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 302 of Friends with Fantasy Benefits. 300 plus episodes of goodness that you've gotten from us. So hopefully we've been entertaining. We've certainly tried. Remember us and keep us in mind. The podcastawards.com nominations are going on. So we have been very dutiful in trying to get you guys material throughout the year. So nominate us in the sports category. We would absolutely love it.
No more big words from you, Chuck.
Okay. I can't help it. I'm a big word kind of guy. That's Eli Rosenzweig, if you guys didn't know. And it's been like a year and a half since I've had the good fortune of doing a show with Eli. Eli is subbing in for Justin Mason, who's on vacation and is kind of chiming in chat rooms, but can't pick up the players he wants. We're hearing all this whining going on. At least it's not about his sunburnt feet this time.
I don't understand how he's got wireless connection to post on Facebook Messenger, but not to make moves on a fantasy app. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does. But Eli, why don't you update myself and everyone else as to what you work on these days and what's going on with you?
Well, there is no update. I'm the most boring individual ever. I'm never working on anything, and I'm always in a bad mood. So that's me in a nutshell, buddy.
Oh, well, that works out wonderfully. That's also my role on this show, is to always be in a bad mood. So it'll be interesting to see how we can mesh our interlocking negativity, if you will. Well,
We got Darius here. That's all we really need.
That's probably true. And Darius, on the other hand, is always working. He's like a workaholic. So, Darius, why don't you tell us not only where you can be reached, but also tell us what extracurricular activity is pushing you the most these days?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at DariusA64. I have to say, before I plug anything, that I did think we were going to get away from Justin complaining about stuff for a week, but sadly that doesn't seem to be the case. So I guess he's still found a way to bother us, even on holiday.
He likes to be a consistent performer like that, and he is. And, the usual hot button topics and stuff are there for me as well. So I guess I can be predictably annoying as well. So I'm not going to rag on him too much about it. He is definitely the captain that helps keep this ship together. So anyway, I compiled a list full of players today, and they're sort of bookended. There's one person in the beginning and one person at the end that are different, but then sort of we're going to do the show in couplets after that. And I will further expand upon that. But first and foremost, about a week ago, I was reading on Twitter a vehement argument about the valid play of Gorky's Fernandez. Well, I thought to myself, I should really explore that. And then I included him on this list. Well, since I included him on the list, he's gone 2 for his last 19. He's got 1 stolen base since June 23rd. And he's got a 20% K rate for a guy with 0 home runs and 7 stolen bases. He was in the Mexican League as recently as 2014. So Eli really likes to rag on me about including weird people on these lists when I make them. So Eli, when you looked up Gorky Hernandez, what was your immediate thought?
Well, my immediate thought was either this is a joke or you're trying to run off all the listeners within the first 5 minutes. He's terrible. He's got no power. He doesn't run. He's not even like an empty average kind of player. At least some players can give you average and nothing else. He doesn't give you anything in any category. Like you said, contact hitters should not be striking out 20% of the time, man. Other than Buster Posey, I don't want anything to do with anyone on this team, on my fantasy team. It's like a plague. It's a cancer. It's a sad state of affairs in San Francisco. I'm sorry, Justin.
So I had to play this off like I had to play this off because what I was really going to do is I was going to let, you know, I was going to stay on probation. Justin has put me on probation for ragging on the Giants almost every single week. So instead of directly putting myself on probation, I'm going to put Darius on the spot. And I'm going to say, Darius, do you think that with how limited amount of resources the Giants insist on spending on their offense, do you think that Gorkys Hernandez has a role going forward in the San Francisco Giants outfield?
I kind of think he does, which is depressing because I think he's a replacement level player at best. And I think Eli nailed it. He's basically a zero category contributor for fantasy, I guess. Speed, maybe, if you're really, really desperate, but there's nothing else there. But things keep happening. I kind of wonder if something sinister is going on and he's somehow, you know, making guys trip over in the clubhouse or putting obstacles out there in the outfield, because every time it seems like somebody's come along to take his spot, somebody else gets hurt. Austin Slater was the latest victim. And so it kind of almost seems like we just have to put Gorkys Hernandez in the lineup every day now, because every time we get another outfielder, another one goes down. So I think he's probably going to keep playing. The Giants are terrible anyway. And we don't have like a ton of outfield prospects who aren't hurt now. So yeah, I think he's got a role. I don't think he's particularly useful for fantasy unless you're in like the kind of league where literally every player has to be rostered and he's valuable because he exists. But no, I don't think there's anything here.
Darius, I especially love you right now because Eli said that we were going to lose the listenership in the first 5 minutes, and you brought everybody back with a conspiracy theory, which like Oliver Stone has made a living and a half off of conspiracy theories. So now we have everybody drawn in to the actual meat of the show.
But Chuck, it's irrelevant. Everyone already tuned out, so they're not going to hear the conspiracy theory. That's the problem.
They've literally heard Gorkys Hernandez and just press stop straight away.
They probably deleted the entire podcast from their feed, actually.
There was a legitimate argument about how well Gorkys Hernandez had played up until his last five games that was going on Twitter. And I thought I was missing something. And then I thought, well, somehow he's still in the lineup. So, and now I found out because, you know, all these other people that we barely know the name of are, you know, tripping over, you know, bags full of balls and stuff in the clubhouse, that this is what's going on. But anyway, we have to move on to give everyone a semblance of relevance to this podcast. And this guy, I think, is very relevant. And you'll notice that these next two guys, I'm going to ask you what are similar about them when we get through them. But the first one is Ian Happ, who will be 23 here in less than a month. I wonder, I'm ready for Darius to explain to me, since he is embedded in the Wrigleyville culture these days, what do you think Ian Happ's role is going forward, and are you excited about Ian Happ as a player?
Yeah, I kind of am. I mean, he's still only 22, so he's had a few struggles. I think the strikeouts are a little on the high side, but he's kind of holding his own pretty well for somebody at that age in his debut season. I kind of feel like Madden wants him to be the new Zobrist, with the old Zobrist kind of looking a bit tired now, and he's hitting about 200, and I think we're coming towards the end of his career, and we've got Happ out here playing second base and left field and centre field and right field. It kind of feels like Joe's sort of thinking, oh, great, I've got a replacement at just the right time for my favourite versatile player. So, yeah, I think he has got a role. I know there's a lot of shuffling that goes on there in Chicago. I don't think every player necessarily deals with it that well. But maybe the fact that Happ's kind of come up and he's already had to get used to it straight away will help him. And I certainly think there's power here. And I think he's pretty fast as well. So I think he can give you a decent number of steals. So I think there is a role. Whether he'll play every day probably depends on quite a lot of moving pieces that I don't want to predict. But I think by the end of the season, he'll have a decent number of counting stats to keep you going for fantasy.
Well, he's certainly an interesting guy. Eli, what are your base thoughts on one Ian Happ?
Yeah, I like him as well. I definitely think he'll play every day, especially now that looks like Chris Bryant got banged up today. I don't know how serious that's going to be, but even still, Happ's been playing pretty much every day. Like Zobrist, he's versatile, can play a few different spots in the field. He kind of reminds me a little bit of Michael Conforto. I think that Happ flew through the minors so quickly that there wasn't much time to kind of build him up as a prospect, so he kind of flew under the radar because of it. But much like Conforto, all he did was hit at every single level, and he's been, you know, even better in the majors. He's got elite power for a guy with second base eligibility. He's been hitting in a pretty prime spot in the order, so he should score and drive in a good amount of runs and a pretty good lineup. So, and like Chuck said, Darius said, he'll sprinkle in some steals as well. So he's a pretty complete fantasy player at such a young age.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you guys. I'm pretty excited about he. Not only has he been put in the lineup, but it seems like he's been hitting towards the middle of the lineup a lot of the time already, which is great news. I mean, the 3 stolen bases, 13 home runs, 56 games, 33 RBIs and 30 runs scored. I mean, basically he's played a third of a season, so that gives you an idea of what kind of pace he's at. 862 OPS for a kid who's 22 years old, be 23 here in less than a month. So there's something to be said for that. Now the person I'm comparing and contrasting him with is one Whitley Merrifield, who of course has one of the most hoity-toity names in all of sports, if you include the L-E-Y at the end of his first names. So how about Whit Merrifield? You own any shares of Whit Merrifield, Eli, and what are your thoughts on him and his breakout season?
Nobody really cares about Whit Merrifield. He was never a prospect. He plays on a team that is largely irrelevant, and his name is Whit goddamn Merrifield. But you know what? Guys like this can honestly help you win leagues. Only Trey Turner and Billy Hamilton have more steals than Merrifield over the last month. He's a .284 lifetime hitter. You know, his power and run production are not great, but it's pretty serviceable for a middle infielder. So if you can pick up Whit Merrifield in a deep league, you know, even in a shallow league, he can help you with the steals. He's a pretty solid little player. You know, you can rag on him, but he's pretty good.
Yeah, he's kind of easy to rag on. I mean, they moved up, what, a 21 or 22-year-old kid, Mondesi, to start at second base to start the season, and that worked horribly. I bet you they wish they had just gone with Merrifield and saved the service time for Mondesi Jr. How about you, Darius? What are your thoughts on Whit Merrifield, both the season he's had so far, and what do you think his role might be going forward here?
Yeah, I'm really impressed, especially with his base running prowess. He's gone 15 for 16, so he's super efficient. I mean, he's a guy who stole 20-plus bases in four different minor league seasons, so he's kind of always had this in his pocket, but he really seems to be making it play in the majors this year. I think he's got a pretty good kind of all-fields approach. You're not going to get a ton of power out of him, but he does hit quite a lot of doubles. He's already had 21 this year. And so I think if you're in a league that counts that, whether you use total bases or slugging, something like that, he may be worth a look as well. Kind of a sneaky guy who's maybe hidden because he doesn't hit a lot of home runs. And he's been leading off basically for 6 weeks since Ned Yost finally came to his senses and took Alcides Escobar out of the leadoff spot. So, yeah, I really like Merrifield. I think he's kind of got a lot of interesting tools, and the Royals have been a lot better, especially since they got rid of Mondesi. So I think he could score a decent number of runs too.
Obviously, the speed with Merrifield's legit, so I'm not, like, criticizing anything here, but I just feel like every single player in baseball had, like, 20-plus steals in a minor league season. I feel the catchers in the minors must really fucking suck.
I might do a study on this. Does every player steal 20 bases in the minors?
God, I'm telling you, look it up, man.
When I was studying Gary Sanchez the other day, I realized that, you know, that he had 8 steals last year. And he doesn't even look like he can run at all. And he's got a couple steals already. So as much as stolen bases seem to be such a scarce commodity, they seem to pop up in the oddest of places. My comments on Whit Merrifield are, he's really helped a lot of people this year. If you had injuries in the middle infield and you picked him up, he's been surprisingly productive. And some of the underlying numbers really look pretty good. You know, his ground ball percentage is down 7%. His K rate is down 8% from 2016. And the very tenuous tie-in that I'm playing between Ian Happ and Whit Merrifield is that Whit Merrifield has 16 games in the outfield, so he's likely to be outfield and second base eligible, much the same as Ian Happ. So they'll both be position flexibility guys that maybe end up as a middle infielder next year. And I would also ask the question, is Whit Merrifield a guy that may benefit from what's going to happen in the offseason with the Royals going forward, meaning that amongst the rubble of them likely almost certainly losing Hosmer, nearly certainly losing Moustakas, Kane will be hard to retain. I mean, all the parts that they're going to lose in the offseason, maybe Whit Merrifield is actually gets moved to the middle of the lineup, or gets relied on further than he has been before, and maybe actually kind of benefits from them losing all those pieces parts. I know, Eli, you like to furl a brow at my goofy theories. So what are your thoughts on that? You think Whit Merrifield's one of the last guys standing next year in Kansas City or what?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. You know, they've done a great job running their organization for the past 5 years, but I feel like they've really, really messed up this past year. I know they're trying to go forward, and they do have a chance to make the playoffs, I suppose, but I think this franchise is going in the wrong direction. It's going to go – it could get really ugly really quickly if they lose all those guys, and they don't really have a farm system like they used to anymore. It's going to be hard to get free agents there. I think they got a long road ahead. So, sadly, yeah, Merrifield's probably going to play – a big part of their team for the next couple of years.
Hey, somebody's still got to score runs next year, right? There's still bad relief pitchers that'll be in for other teams, you know, bad starts. Somebody's got to, you know, somebody's got to drift through the rubble and find some value. And for some reason, I think Whit Merrifield might be the guy. You think there's any chance Whit Merrifield takes another step forward next year, Darius?
I don't know about that. He's already 28. I'm not sure I see a huge step forward coming from him in terms of what he's done this year. There's nothing that leaps out to me as saying that there's more to come here. Obviously, we've seen guys have weird breakouts at age 29, 30. So it's possible. But I do think the Royals are going to be pretty bad next year. I don't know how much value there's going to be. I'd certainly much rather have Happ longer term, and I think probably Merrifield will be kind of pretty cheap because the situation is going to be unattractive, and it may well be like this year where he's going to help a lot of people out who didn't have to pay anything for him, and they can use him as a middle infield or utility outfield guy. But I think probably this is what he is, and speed and a tiny bit of power and a decent source of runs.
Well, at-bats is currency, right? That's what they say in some leagues. And if you're going to be in a deep enough league next year where at-bats are currency, you're hoping that Whit Merrifield gets those extra four games in the outfield. So maybe you can install his at-bats there if you end up with a surplus at second base. Okay, well, let's move on to a couple of pitchers, and let's start with one of the rare drafting success stories for me this year, and that would be one Luis Severino, who's just 23 years old with a 3.09 FIP. What are your thoughts, and what do you think the ceiling is here for Luis Severino, Darius?
I think the ceiling's really high. I mean, the peripherals look outstanding. I think his ERA is probably still even a little bit high for what he's been doing. He's getting a ton of swings and misses. The slider is amazing. It's really good. He's good at getting both strikeouts with it and a ton of ground balls. The way he's locating is much better. I think he's not leaving anything out over the plate like he was last year. And the mechanics are a lot better. He's a lot less inconsistent, I think, than he was last year as well. So I like everything he's done. I think this is still a really young guy, and I think the ceiling is super high. I mean, we're talking a definite top 20, maybe top 15 starter. And I think based on the improvements he's made this year, who's to say that he couldn't add another pitch or improve one of his existing pitches and take another step forward over the next 12 months. So, yeah, I love Severino and everything he's done this year, and I'm really impressed.
Well, that was amazingly done, because my byline to this heading under Severino is top 20 starter going forward, ? Maybe even top 15, ? Which is exactly what you just said. But we've always got Eli to supply some snark. So are you going to rain on our Severino parade here, or are you a believer now?
No, I'm right in line with you guys. I have listed as top 15. I don't think he's getting enough credit. He's only 23. He's been the best starter on the Yankees in a pennant race when they've needed him the most, with Tanaka having a wretched season. The K rate's up. The ground ball rate's up as well. He slashed his walk rate. You know, last year's disaster was just clearly an aberration. There's also no signs of luck here at all. The BABIP, homer to fly ball, and left on base percentage all support a guy that's actually been a little bit unlucky this year. So, yeah, he's absolutely top 15 right now for me, and he's got potential to even grow a little bit more, like Darius said, if he can improve a pitch or add a pitch.
Well, let's compare and contrast him to a lefty pitcher who is on the mound as we speak, and that would be 28-year-old James Paxton, who I've got to admit, I did not realize that he was 28 years old. I don't know why. I thought he was younger than that. But James Paxton, Big Maple is his nickname. He's likewise has a 10.3 K per nine, which was not the only tie-in I was going with between him and Severino, because they're both the same. But I'm really curious as to if you have as many expectations, if you think Paxton is a comparable pitcher to Severino going forward. Why don't we start with you right away, Eli?
He's definitely comparable. I have him about a tick below Severino. I think he's more like a top 25 kind of guy. He can certainly be really dominant like Severino can, but the problem is there's just too many times where he's banged up and not on the field. You know, we fall in love with the Ks, but he can be wild at times. He doesn't go as deep into games as the other aces do. So, I like Severino a little bit more, but Paxton, you know, he's pretty great too.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot to like when he's going well, that's for sure. And I just want to mention that, you know, one advantage he has over Severino is that he doesn't pitch in, New Yankee Stadium. Darius, what have your thoughts been drifting towards on Mr. Paxton?
Yeah, I mean, Eli said most of what I would. I think he's been very impressive when he's on the field, and I think the injury concerns are just much greater for him. If I could be sure that he was going to throw 180, 190 innings at least, then I think I would have a hard time splitting these two up. But as it is, he's got a pretty long history of not pitching a ton of innings, and he's already 28. We've never really seen that kind of full workload from him, so I think I have more concerns on that front, and that alone pushes him down. But on pure talent and stuff alone, I think I would have these two very close in the rankings.
I guess one other thing I wanted to point to with these two pitchers is they're going to end up falling right in that range with some of the guys that we've sort of been waiting on or have had their injury concerns, the Carlos Carrascos, et cetera. And I wonder are you going to be more willing, you know, in the early middle draft, the fourth, fifth, sixth round kind of slots in shallower leagues, are you going to be more enthused in taking a Severino, a Paxton, a Berríos than you would be in guys that have done it before, but we've seen kinks in their armor, you know, like the Cleveland starters after Kluber? What are your thoughts, Darius? Is this the kind of guy you want to, these the kind of guys you want to invest in more so than the steady veterans or the veterans that pitch good when they're on the mound? What do you think?
Yeah, I think I might tend towards that. I know Paxton has changed his delivery, and that was a relatively recent thing. So whether that will help him stay healthier, he has already been hurt this year, of course, so maybe that undermines that point. But I do think I'm a little bit more inclined to go for kind of the upside of these younger guys, and maybe we've seen guys like Carrasco, he's done it in sort of stretches, but we've had several years now really of kind of hoping that he'll do the whole season of being elite, and it hasn't really come to pass. And so I think there is that temptation to go for these younger guys who maybe you think, well, they've still got time to figure it out, they're not that old, although as you say Paxton is 28. I think it's one of those situational things as well, maybe in terms of the team balance, and I might be more inclined to get take guys like Paxton if I think I've got a solid start, if I've got somebody like a Scherzer who I'm really confident that I can rely on. And I think I'm relatively confident in Severino's health at this point as well, whereas guys like Paxton and Carrasco, who do seem to get hurt at least once every year, I think I want to make sure I've got at least that one ace who I can count on before I invest the kind of capital you're probably going to need next year to draft them.
Somebody needs to fact check for me, but I seem to recall, and I know this year with the 10-day DL, it might not matter much, but I think Severino was on the DL for a short stretch too early in the season. For some reason, I recall that. Maybe one of you guys could help me out and look that up while I move us on to the next.
Yeah.
Moving forward in sort of this pitching theory section, I'm going to compare and contrast two very different bounce back candidates that we have here in the midseason. And we're going to start with Julio Teheran, which he's 26 years old only now, by the way. Seems like he's been around so much longer than Paxton. But I'm wondering if there's ever been a more fluctuating player than Julio Teheran over this last 4 or 5 year stretch of his career. You know, it's hard to imagine a pitcher able to allow a 4.6 ERA, 4.69 exactly, while allowing only a 268 BABIP. You know, the home runs and the bases on balls are definitely part of it. But Eli, let's go to you and ask you if you have hope for Teheran going forward, and do you think he's going to get traded?
I do have hope. I know he's been pretty terrible. Everything's gone in the tank. The K rate, the walk rate, home run rate, left on base percentage, swing strike rate. It seems like the elite slider from the past few years has kind of eluded him. That might be the main culprit for him. But I just think, honestly, a lot of this just has to do with that he's sick and tired of pitching for a garbage team. He's probably sick and tired of trade rumors all the time and still being on this garbage team. I just feel like if you put this guy on a winning team, give him a new outlook on life, he kind of returns to the consistent guy he's been for most of his career, you know, the top 30, top 25 kind of guy. I'm absolutely buying low on him, both for the rest of this season and long term, whether he gets traded or not. It could be a lost year, but I just feel like he's too talented, too young, and he's been too consistent over the last 4 years for the most part to not bounce back.
Well, the scary guy, of course, too, and they're completely different pitchers in their arsenal, etc. But Shelby Miller is the scary guy because I remember thinking that Shelby Miller was too good to be permanently in the tank, which he was coming out of the tank before he got hurt this year, in all fairness. But Darius, I am curious as to what your thoughts are on Julio Teheran. And did you find out, did Severino have a stint on the DL earlier this year?
Looks to me like he's made every start. He's made 18. I think it looks like there was a period at the end of April where he maybe had a couple of days. He got pushed back 7 or 8 days between starts. But yeah, I think he's made basically every turn in the rotation this year.
Yeah, get your facts straight, Chuck. God.
You know, it's so good to be working with smart people. By the way, like in case anyone was wondering if I'm big and dumb, like I obviously can't do two things at once because I can't host and fact check at the same time. But fortunately, Darius is a good multitasker. So, Darius, what are your thoughts on Julio Teheran?
I think, unusually, I'm going to be the negative guy here. I've heard people saying that he doesn't like the mound at SunTrust. I don't know. I couldn't really find out any more on that. I tried Googling a few things and looking at beat writers' articles, and I couldn't really find much mention of that. So I don't know where people were getting that from. But the results certainly indicate that he doesn't like the new park. What really concerns me is that the problems with lefties have not gone away, even in this recent good stretch. He's had 8 walks and 11 strikeouts against the left-handers he's faced in July, so he's almost kind of a 1-to-1 ratio there. It's only a really low sub-200 BABIP that's saved him. And I was interested in the start against the Cubs on Monday because that was kind of the first time that he seemed to have pitched reasonably well at home for a while. And that was kind of a 2-run start that could easily have been a 5 or 6. Just so happened that Freddie Freeman was at first base for that game. Matt Adams wasn't starting, and he saved him twice with absolute rockets down the line. I'm not sure Adams would have made both of those plays, and it could easily have turned into a 5-6 run game for him. It's all fastball at the moment. The secondary stuff is not there. He just can't get left-handers out. John Lester hit a double off him that was nearly a home run. I'm not sure what the problem is. He doesn't seem to have any confidence in that breaking stuff, and I don't know where that's gone. But if he's just going to rely on the fastball as much as he has been lately, then I think it's going to turn sour again pretty quick. And I don't know where the bounce back is coming from until he rediscovers that command and that secondary stuff.
Holy shit, you've convinced me. If John Lester can lace a double off him, all hope is lost.
Yeah, he walked Lester twice, maybe, I think. Yeah, he got absolutely crushed by him.
Yeah, and Lester stole a base, by the way, which you don't see every day for a starting pitcher. There were a number of promising starts for Teheran and leading up to this start against the Cubs. And I know the start against the Cubs could have been worse, but I can tell you from personally having to suffer through ownership all this time in deep leagues, etc., that Teheran has also had a number of starts where he really got lambasted by bad relief pitching after he left the game. And I think their lack of starting pitching in general has led them to try and lean on Teheran, someone maybe they shouldn't have, meaning that they could have gotten him out of some games earlier and saved him from some trouble as well. But the person that I want to compare and contrast Julio Teheran to, oddly enough, is 25-year-old Aaron Sanchez, who seems like he should be younger than Teheran because his major league cycle his major league service time started so much later. But I'm going to ask the question if we can throw out 2017 for the young Blue Jay hurler known as Aaron Sanchez. And if you guys think there's some kind of K-rate rebound on its way, because he only has one start all year, this whole year, with over 4 Ks in it. So Aaron Sanchez, what are your thoughts on him, Darius?
Yeah, this year is so hard to get a read on. I think today's start is going to be the first time this year he's made three in a row. So it's just really difficult to get a grip on what he is this year. And the walks have been really disappointing. And as you say, the strikeouts have been even lower. So I think if we can get anywhere near to last year, then he's obviously still a really valuable starter. But one of the attractions of Sanchez, I think, was that he was an efficient guy, and we thought he could pitch 200 innings again. And he doesn't have the highest strikeout rate in the world, but if you've got a guy who pitches 200 with so many pitchers out there now who do get kind of pushed back and slotted on the 10-day DL to get extra rest, and you know, you're lucky to get 150, 160, then that was kind of a valuable commodity. But I don't know if it's this new ball that's bothering him even more with the blisters. He didn't sound that confident that they were completely behind him, although it's encouraging that he's actually going to make three starts in a row. But this kind of thing, we remember what happened with Rich Hill, where he just couldn't seem to shake those issues off for months and months. And I kind of worry a bit about that with Sanchez, and whether the differences with the new ball are exacerbating his problems. So it's really difficult for me to get a read on what he is this year and whether he can find himself again to what we saw last year. But right now I need to see quite a bit more consistency, I think. And yeah, I'd love to see the control come back, because what it's been so far this year just isn't good enough for somebody who's not even getting to 8Ks per night.
Yeah, he was such a promising starter after last season. And so we were certainly hoping for more. And you guys have hinted at the tenuous correlation that I'm making between Julio Teheran and Aaron Sanchez here, in so much as Teheran has completely lost his slider. And Sanchez is part of this blister conspiracy theory that's going on, that since the seams on the ball have been lowered, that these pitchers have had to squeeze the ball harder to try and create action on it. And that's why we've had more blister issues than we've had in the past. And it has severely curtailed the effectiveness of Sanchez and Teheran. That's one theory. Also at play here is that now Major League Baseball is claiming that they're inspecting the new ball, and not because they care about the extra home runs, but because they're concerned about player safety, which of course is something that Eli could certainly snark at us about if he wished. But the point being is that not only do I want to get Eli's thoughts on Aaron Sanchez, but I want to get his thoughts on this blister thing and the new baseball. And then I want him to include in his analysis if he would rather have Teheran or Sanchez going forward. So what do you think, Eli?
You're asking for too much, man. That's a lot of, I'll try to cover all of it. I love Aaron Sanchez, but I think we overrated him a little bit. I'm not just saying that because of the struggles this year, but I mean, he won 15-2 last year. So a lot of the praise and how great he was in the fantasy wise was because of the fortunate win-loss record. I mean, his other numbers were solid. I love pitchers that go 190 innings and give you a decent amount of strikeouts and give you a 3 ERA, but he walked too many guys, didn't strike out quite enough. He's been kind of inconsistent in his whole career. I know he's still pretty young, but he's up and down from the rotation to the bullpen, being healthy, not being healthy. I like him, but I think he was always a little bit overrated. I prefer Teheran, honestly. He's in the National League. It's that simple. If it was the other way around and Sanchez was in the National League and Teheran was in the American League, I would flip my answer. These guys are pretty close in terms of talent. They're pretty close in terms of age. I always just lean towards a guy pitching in the National League because I think pitching in the National League is a fucking joke, and I still think people don't quite understand how much easier it is to pitch in the National League. Like, put Chris Sale in the National League. He's fucking Clayton Kershaw, all right? This makes me angry. Chris Sale is so much better than Max Scherzer. Can I get a confirmation on that from someone, please?
I don't know.
Kershaw's the GOAT. I'm not going to say Sale's better than Kershaw because he's not. But I just think Sale's a good amount better than Scherzer. Put him in. Sale gets just as many Ks as Scherzer. I mean, as Kershaw, and he gets to face DHs instead of pitchers. Sale's so underrated. I'll go to my deathbed on this one. I know people realize now that he's a stud, but he's even better than most people realize. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. the balls. I mean, I think Major League Baseball is full of shit. Like, yeah, the balls are within, like, the accepted range or whatever. But was it Ben Lindbergh from the Ringer who did the story on this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he made a pretty good case here. Like, the accepted range between the balls is a joke. So they need to tighten that range. I'm not buying what the commissioner is selling. I don't care what they're doing. Just don't lie and feed us bullshit. whatever. The blister is always going to be a problem with pitchers. Maybe the ball is contributing to some extra cases this year, but whatever. I'm not too worried about it. It's pretty much, it seems like it's only like Rich Hill and Aaron Sanchez problem. Are there other guys that are having consistent problems?
I believe there's been a couple other pitchers, and one of the other pitchers
with DL with blisters as well.
Yeah, and then he's the one who brought up. He was the one that spit out the angst against Major League Baseball and sort of brought the theory up in and of itself. But as long as we're, you know, as long as Eli's a three sport maestro, and the fact that we're talking about, you know, the ball theory, etc. I wonder if anyone's checked to see exactly how much pressure the baseball's pumped up to, or if if David Stern tried to implement a new ball without checking it through with the players. So there, I covered all three sports for us.
What a disaster that was! My God.
All right. Well, you know, I'm going to make a break here for a second from our player analysis, because it's wonderful timing that Eli is on the pod with us today, because last night, of course, was the big trade that I absolutely ranted and raved about on Twitter last night. So if you follow me on Twitter, you probably know what my take is going to be. But I am very curious, because I didn't hear any White Sox fans chime in on how they felt about the haul that they got for three of their most valuable pieces remaining on the team. So what are your thoughts on Blake Rutherford, and do you think that they got enough for combination of their third baseman Todd Frazier, and they also traded their two best relief pitchers in Robertson and in Conley? What do you think, Eli?
Well, I didn't love the haul. Certainly not as I don't like it as much as a lot of their other deals recently. But you know, at the same time, Frazier was a free agent after the season. He hasn't exactly been great. So they're not exactly. I mean, in terms of the White Sox, you're not really losing a lot. Like, they're not going to be competing for a title next year. So the fact that they're losing Robertson, who only had one more year left, is not that big of a deal either. They saved some money in the process. You know, Canley's the big loss, but he's only been good for about, 3 months in his entire life for the most part. So I like Canley, and he certainly was an asset because he's going to be controllable for the next 3 years at a good price. So I get it. But relievers are so, like, next year you could suck for all we know. And the White Sox have a ton of good prospects and that are probably going to end up being relievers. And like Carson Fulmer's probably going to be a good reliever instead of a starter. And same could be for Reynaldo Lopez. And at some point, Zach Birdie will come back from his Tommy John. So I'm not really worried about the bullpen. You can make a bullpen. They don't need to worry about the bullpen now. They need to worry about the bullpen in 3 years when they're actually competing. So I don't really care what they lost. In terms of Rutherford, you know, he's fine. I'm not really as big of a prospect guy as I used to, because I dropped all my dynasty leagues, so I don't obsess over every single prospect now that I used to. But you know, I know Keith Law is a little bit down on him from where he was at the beginning of the season, but he still obviously was a high first round pick last year. Certainly got some talent. I like what the White Sox are doing. So not the best trade in the world, but it still made sense for the organization. A good trade for both teams.
Darius, what was your both your knee-jerk reaction, and knowing you, you probably delved into it already. What was your thoughts on the big trade last night?
Yeah, I think, it did seem a bit disappointing, and I think part of that is because the White Sox have made some absolutely terrific trades to boost their farm system lately, and Rutherford is not really impressed in his first full year, and I think he has taken a bit of a slide down the prospect lists, so kind of the mid-season ones that have come out so far. He's kind of dipped down from where he was preseason. But I think people thought he was a guy who was going to be able to hit for average and have a decent amount of power as well. So I think he's probably still got a lot of time to improve, and 3 months isn't really something we should worry too much about. So I think looking at his value from a preseason standpoint, I think it's a good get. And I think it's a good idea to deal relievers when they're at the peak of their value, because they change so quickly, and like Eli said, Conley's been incredible for 3 months, and his chances are, you know, we could come out next year and he'll be gone back to being terrible again. These things change so fast. So while he's got a lot of control, the White Sox don't need him right now, and I think to get back a pretty decent prospect who is still going to be, I think, in a lot of top 50s is a pretty good deal. And they got three other guys as well, none of whom I think are particularly high end, but I think just filling out the farm system with as much talent as they've got now is the goal. and Frazier wasn't going to bring back a ton anyway. And from what people were saying about what the Red Sox were going to give up, it was, you know, basically nothing to try and trade for him as well. So I think people might be overrating his role in the deal because he's not been that good and he only has half a year of control left. So, yeah, I think it's not super exciting, but I think it'll probably work out pretty well for the White Sox long term.
It was also really smart to bundle all three together, because if you sell like Frazier to the Red Sox and Robertson and Kane, if you do it all separate, you're not going to get one stud prospect. I know Rutherford's not exactly a stud prospect in a lot of people's eyes anymore, but if you sell them all individually, you don't get the one big name, one top 50 guy. So I really like that they did that, and I like that it was a bat, because, you know, and a lot of these trades, the White Sox have kind of loaded up with the arms. I think it's time to start getting some offensive talent in the system.
Well, you know, just when you guys thought maybe you could go a whole week without a rant from me, this happened last night, and that sort of ends that. The only thing, I agree with most of what was said, but a lot of the reaction that I heard from people on Twitter was talking about how great the whole system is for the White Sox. And to me, that really doesn't have anything to do with this individual move. I thought that when I compared the haul that, you know, that the Pirates got from Melanson, the haul that the Yankees got for Aroldis Chapman, which I know sounds weird because he's back as a Yankee now, I didn't think that they got anywhere as close to what those teams got. I also am a strong believer that there's a huge difference between a top 10 prospect. They're including people and they're saying, oh, they have this many top 70 prospects. Well, the list of people who fall out of, you know, the neighborhood from 30 to 70 out of the top 100, you know, is huge. And top 10 prospects are top 10 surefire major league players. When you have a guy that everyone is talking about is at least 3 years away in Blake Rutherford, who hasn't even shown any power yet, and that's why, you know, analysts are down on him to this point. I just thought that in this market where the, you know, obviously the Nats are in dire need of a closer and other teams were going to be as we got closer to the deadline, it just stunned me how little they got in this individual move. I mean, I looked up the other guys, and the one guy's a lefty who most people think is going to be a reliever if everything goes right, maybe could be a back end kind of guy. I don't know. I just I was stunned by this individual move, even though I agree with Eli that the overall direction of what the White Sox have done this year is really exciting. But I don't think that means that criticism for this move in and of itself should be alone. I mean, I make the comparison in my head that, you know, it's a business entity that you have. You have assets, and those assets need to be used properly. And I don't think that Robertson and Conley in and of themselves was enough for that young of an outfielder. I think they should have pitted teams against each other and tried to get something more. I sort of thought maybe Clint Frazier was coming back, et cetera, and so forth when I initially heard the trade, and I'm a little stunned by what they got. But, you know, as usual, these trades, we'll see how it works out over time, but I wanted to do a little current events, especially since we had a White Sox guru who, by the way, put me on the spot before, and I just want to mention that I think both Scherzer and Sale are better than Kershaw. So there you go.
Well, that's crazy.
Wow.
That's why.
I don't think that. But
that's why I was taken aback. I think Kershaw is Kershaw's the extra mileage that we've seen on Kershaw at such a young age, I think over time is going to play itself out. So, but that's been a topic that we've covered on the other show extensively. That well, I'm a Scherzer guy going forward.
Can we talk real quick about the fantasy impact on this trade?
I would love it if you would. Fire away, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too complicated. Robertson obviously goes from, you know, a top 15 closer to pretty much irrelevant completely. In terms of who closes for the White Sox, it could be a bullpen by calamity situation. It could be Clippard. It could be Swarzak. I kind of think that they're going to do Swarzak. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to put Swarzak in, try to increase his trade value, and get rid of him too. I don't know. That's certainly possible. Or it could be Clippard. Although this, let's be real, there's not going to be too many save chances in that shithole the rest of the season. Moncada's up, and that's really all that matters. And I'm a little bummed that he's hitting sixth today. The lineup just got posted about a half hour ago. I'm not surprised, but I just get him at bats, man. Put him in the two hole, for the love of God, or lead him off. Don't put him six. That's stupid.
This was one of the best moments that I've ever had with Eli on a podcast, because he started with closer by calamity, which I've never heard before, which is actually pretty funny in and of itself. Darius, you want to make a fearless prediction on, it's so hard when players first get called up. And I know last year Moncada did not look especially ready, which surprised people because he had pretty good season down there.
Me. That was 20 fucking at-bats, man. That's so stupid.
But what, Darius, if you had to project going forward, what do you think? You think there's a chance that Moncada at such a young age is already like a top 15 third baseman? Boy, that's a loaded position right now.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not yet. He's still very young, and I think probably based on how he's hitting in the minors, it's time for him to come and get an extended look at the big leagues. But there's no way I'd put him in the top 15 just yet. I think there's probably still plenty for him to learn, and the White Sox have got plenty of time for him to make mistakes and fail a bit, and hopefully come around by the time that they're ready to compete again. But there's no way I'd put him in the top 15 right now.
Yeah, to make a comment on the status of where third base is in the big leagues right now, Carlos Correa goes down for 6 to 8 weeks with the thumb injury the other day, and Yulieski Gurriel gets moved into the number three hole, and he's a guy that is largely unowned in a lot of leagues because he only has 11 home runs. I mean, he's hitting almost 300, by the way, but now he's in the middle of an Astros lineup. And he's not even close to breaking the top 15 at third base. Probably not even the top 20 because of the low home run total. And also because there was a logjam for playing time there for a while. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I've also made a comment before that Bregman is largely considered to be a better shortstop defensively than Correa. So I'll be curious to see if Bregman gets most of the starts at short here for a while. And then for all you people who like bounce back candidates next year, Alex Bregman would be a more interesting bounce back candidate if you could use him at shortstop or at third base going forward.
It's important to note that Moncada will be playing second. He's third base eligible, but once he gets 10 games at second, he'll be eligible there. But yeah, he's going to be second every day.
Well, this was one of the goofiest positional things going on, because I assumed that Frazier was going to be playing third in New York, and some people on Twitter last night were insisting that he was going to be playing first, which I guess I could see to a certain extent because he does have some experience at first. And then some people were claiming that they were going to use Moncada at third when he was brought up. I can't believe they would want to change positions on him as he's as he's getting his second taste in the bigs. So unless he was playing third down in the minors, I couldn't see him moving to third yet either. But there's going to be some interesting long-term ramifications from this, to say the least. And it's pretty exciting. This trade deadline thing sort of is exciting. It's almost like the hot stove in the middle of the summer, yeah,
Matt,
if you will.
Matt Davidson's getting the start of third today. I'm sure he'll get some more at-bats. Yolmer Sanchez will probably get a little bit more time. Yeah, not exactly exciting stuff, but that's probably what's going to happen.
Well, you know, that's what happens in a rebuild, brother. I know my Brewers have been there for quite a while. Let's compare and contrast two more players, and this one I think will be easier for you guys to see a connection to. But let's talk about Ben Gamel, the long-haired, flowing robe right fielder today for the Seattle Mariners, with his .418 BABIP and .320 batting average, just 25 years old. It's been an interesting grab bag of stuff going on. I know our own Matt Thompson is quite the fan of Ben Gamel. Darius, what are your thoughts on Ben Gamel going forward? Do you think he's a long-term solution in the outfield for Seattle?
I think he's an extremely useful player. He's pretty fast, I think, and the disappointment for me so far is that he hasn't run more. He's only got the three steals on the three attempts, so it's not like he's been trying an awful lot, and I think I kind of expected him to have that as his main appeal in fantasy, but the batting average is obviously great. He seems to be a particularly good hitter. But I don't think there's a lot of power there. And you mentioned the BABIP, which is going to come down. So I think that the average is not going to look anywhere near as rosy in fairly short order. He's getting to bat second quite a lot of the time on the Mariners lineup as well, which is fairly decent with Cruz and Cano and Kyle Seager in there. So I like that too. But I think he's kind of he's one of these players that Jerry DePoto's kind of the more athletic, speedy, improved their defensive ability, which they have done quite a lot this year over last season. I think it's kind of a more of a real life utility than fantasy, because I just don't see huge counting stats coming unless for some reason he drastically ups his stolen base rate all of a sudden, which he hasn't done through these first 3 months.
Well, I guess so far it appears that his best ability has been to score runs, which I know there's always this cult theory that runs are the category that we often forget about. But I wonder, Eli, what do you think, Ben Gamo, his ceiling here in the next couple years? You think he can get up to being like a number three fantasy outfielder, or do you think that's too ambitious?
That's too ambitious. I liked Gamo, but now that I know that Matt Thompson gives him his endorsement, that kind of scares me off. Matt Thompson thinks Magnanimous Sierra, or whatever the fuck his name is in St. Louis, is like going to be Mike Trout or something. Yeah, I think Gamble's solid. He's one of the kinds of players I like to get for cheap in AL-only leagues. That's one of my last outfielders. Obviously that BABIP's out of control, so he's more of like a 275 kind of hitter probably than a 320. I think in a full season he can give you like 8 homers, 12 steals, something along those lines. But the problem is I don't know if he's a lock for long-term playing time in Seattle necessarily. Once Tyler O'Neill is up, I think Gamble is the odd man out. I suppose it could be Dyson, but I think Dyson kind of needs to be the center fielder. I'm not so sure that Gamble or O'Neill or Haniger can really man center field. So I do like Gamble, but I'm just a little worried about his long-term prospects potentially.
Yeah, I think Gamble's in kind of an interesting position because, you know, with Robinson Cano and that huge contract not looking nearly as bad as we thought it might already, and Nelson Cruz, definitely holding up well over the test of time, it seems like being in Seattle is a pretty good place to be. You know, they're getting an awful lot out of batting average-wise, at least, not as much power as we thought out of Segura. So there's some interesting pieces, parts, and I don't know if Haniger's whole season was derailed by that injury, but he hasn't looked to be the same since he came off the DL. So it's interesting if he can hold a spot and can keep scoring runs, he can be kind of an interesting late-game outfield play for sure, as far as I see it. But I really want to see that situation to develop, and I think Eli's got a good point. When I thought about it, I wasn't sure if he really fit into their long-term plans or not. And I'm not really sure he's an upper division regular. He may be kind of a lower division regular if he can't control that 24% K rate, which is an awful lot for a guy with his kind of bat-to-ball skills. Anyway, the guy I'm going to make a pretty obvious comparison to is one Bradley Zimmer, who is Justin Mason's boy, who's 24 years old. He's got 5 home runs, but he's got 10 stolen bases. His BABIP is a little more under control with 351. He is the Cleveland Indians outfielder, who I'll be curious to see if he loses any playing time here with Tyler Naquin, who I've always thought is a vastly overrated player, coming back off the DL. So, Bradley Zimmer, what do you think, Eli? You a bigger fan of Zimmer than you are Gamel, and do you think he can be a number three outfielder here in the next couple years?
Yeah, I'm a bigger Zimmer fan. I do think he could be a third outfielder. I don't think he's going to lose too much playing time. I'm not too worried about Naquin, just like yourself. I think Zimmer's a big part of their future, and they didn't call him up to sit him. He's going to get regular playing time. He's been pretty solid so far, so I don't think that'll change. I think he's more closer to a 255 hitter than the 270 he's at right now. But I feel like next year, I don't think this is necessarily going to happen, but I wouldn't be stunned if he had like 15 homers and 25 steals. That's something that's a possibility for him. And that's something that only Mookie Betts, Keon Broxton, and Lorenzo Cain are likely to do this year among outfielders. So that, it's, I don't care how low you hit, actually, if you give me 15 homers and 25 steals. So he's got a pretty decent walk rate. He should score a fair amount of runs. He's a pretty complete fantasy player. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Zimmer.
Yeah, I don't blame you thereof. And I just want to mention, since my Brewers are losing every day right now and I don't have much to hang my hat on, that none of those players you mentioned strike out nearly as much as our Keon Broxton does. So there you go. That's my bragging point. Darius, what are your feelings on Bradley Zimmer? You agree that he's a better long-term fit than Ben Gamel for fantasy rosters?
Yeah, this looks more like a player that's going to give us the counting stats we want. And I think I like Eli's projection. I think that's very doable for Zimmer. One thing that's kind of weird to me is that Francona didn't seem to want to play him against left-handed starters while Austin Jackson was healthy. And now that Austin Jackson is on the DL, he's played him almost every day. I don't know whether that's because Terry Francona thinks Austin Jackson is way better than Abraham Almonte. I'm not sure. But that's it. That's definitely a thing that happened. And he's certainly still having trouble against lefties. So I think that could be something that maybe limits his playing time a bit down the stretch. If Francona does have the options to not start him against lefties, I wouldn't be surprised if we see him on the bench those days, at least to start the game. But he's still going to get the strong side of the platoon. And I think he's going to run enough. He's already run plenty in his fairly limited sample. And he's been good at it as well. So I think even if he isn't getting full-time playing time, if you need the steals, then I think Zimmer is going to give you them. So, yeah, I think he's a pretty attractive fantasy option, and the average probably is the main concern long term. But like Eli said, if you're getting that kind of power and speed, then unless he's hitting so badly he gets taken out of the lineup, perhaps like your boy Keon Broxton, it's not going to matter too much.
Well, the one thing I wanted to mention about Zimmer is his 7.7% walk rate is the lowest of his professional career, which I really think is a good sign for the future. He has a history of having a pretty good command of the strike zone as far as being willing to take walks, and that always helps you as far as getting pitches long term. He's one of those guys, seems like he's on more of a traditional performance arc, where I think a few years from now, we could get some surprising sort of top 25 to top 30 kind of outfield seasons out of Bradley Zimmer, who certainly had more of a prospect pedigree than Ben Gamel did. Gamel was kind of the all-around good at every level, whereas Zimmer was the guy that sort of wowed the prospect analysts into thinking that he could be a stud someday. So I'm going to hold on to that and agree with you guys that I think Zimmer is a much better prospect moving forward.
I will give up my firstborn to have Tim Anderson's walk rate at 7.7%.
Wow. Now we're into human trafficking. I guess that's one of the few things some people are trying to attribute to Donald Trump, that he's trying to stop this human trafficking.
No politics talk. Come on.
So
now.
Eli,
this
exactly.
is just what it takes to get Tim.
Just so you know, Eli's opinions do not necessarily reflect that. We are not pro human trafficking here at FWFB.
Oh, it's all irrelevant. No one's going to want to have sex with me to make a baby anyway.
Well, all right, then. We can definitely move on from that quite quickly, can't we, Darius?
I think so.
All right, I want to attack one more thing philosophically here today. And you guys will probably be wondering why this is the launching point for it. But I want to hear what your overall thoughts have been so far about one Edwin Diaz, who is this this crazy commodity going into this season as far as drafts were concerned, because of his ridiculous stuff, despite the fact that he hadn't closed very much. So what are your thoughts going forward, Darius? Are you as high on Edwin Diaz as you were going into the year?
I think I'm a little bit lower maybe, and I don't know that I was as high on him as some people. I know a lot of people kind of had him up in the top five of closers, and I don't think I was there with Diaz. I think the fact that he seems to struggle with his mechanics fairly often, he's still quite raw, and the stuff obviously gets him out of a lot of trouble. And he has been a bit better lately, but I think he's very prone to kind of losing his mechanics and leaving a poor pitch over the plate, or just not being able to find the strike zone. And when those outings go bad, I think they can go really bad. He's still only 23. I think there's probably still plenty for him to learn, and the stuff is so good that if he can iron those issues out and become more consistent, then he could easily be a top two or three closer with the kind of stuff he's got. But yeah, I'm probably going to be a little bit cautious, and I don't really like drafting those kind of intermediate closers in most leagues. If I'm not going to get one of the stud guys, I like to just wait and pick on the undervalued ones towards the end of the draft, and then try and find the guys, unless it's a really deep league where it's impossible to pick relievers up. I just like to pick on those guys at the back end who are maybe a bit underrated because they're on bad teams, or people haven't really paid attention to them because they only started closing in the second half of the year, those kind of guys. So I think Diaz may well fall into that range of a little bit overvalued for me for what he's done this season next year.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about Edwin Diaz, I mean, it's certainly been an interesting ride, considering the fact that we were looking at Tony Zick as possibly as getting picked up in a number of areas as a possible replacement, et cetera, earlier in the season. And he was a very highly touted, you know, closer going into the season. So I'm curious, Eli, have your thoughts wavered, or are you do you think this was just a little turbulence for Edwin Diaz, and next year we should renew our faith in the supreme stuff that he has?
I agree with everything that Darius said. I'm a little bit down on him from where I was, but I still like him. And much like Darius, unless I'm getting one of the stud closers, I'm waiting and drafting the undervalued ones late. I just think it's so easy to find saves at all points during the season. As long as you're paying attention, you can always manufacture some saves, or you can easily trade for saves too. It's hard not to be a little bit down on him. He's down over 2 Ks per 9 from last year. The walks are up over 1 more per 9. The ground balls are down 5% from last year. He's giving up too many homers. The hard hit rate's up 7%. So it's hard not to be a little bit worried, but still, he's on pace for about 100 strikeouts, 30 saves. The whip and ERA are not quite as good as you'd want, but they're still pretty serviceable. I love guys like this. I believe Edwin Diaz will take another jump for next year. I think it'll be great.
Well, it's definitely been an interesting sort of roller coaster year for him. 3.86 walks per 9 is obviously too many, but like Darius pointed to, you can work around that when, you know, you can put a runner on third with nobody out and just strike out the side when you need to. And I think the other really concerning stat is that his home run rate has jumped from 0.87 to 1.82. That's a pretty significant jump. But he's been hot as a pistol lately. He has 2 or more strikeouts in 7 of his last 8 outings, and he has a sub-1 ERA during that stretch of time. So, I mean, I guess, you know, this is sort of poking at how we feel about closing theory, and I've seen some stats about Brandon Kinstler and the Rockies closer, and about how, everyone who has ever said you don't pay for saves, that this is the poster year for it. I mean, even Craig Kimbrell was sort of a low-end, top-tier closer, and, you know, he started out the whole first half of the season, he was virtually untouchable. So I'm always curious, and it's sort of an evolving thing for me on how I feel about closers. I just wish the leagues that I had Ozuna and the leagues that I had Dyson in from Texas, if I could just go back and just wait and just take, you know, Brandon Kinstler. I mean, why invest at all? If you could, hindsight is 20/20 kind of thing here. But I am curious, you know, if he does prove to be streaky, Edwin Diaz, you know, it's very hard to value a streaky closer, because you don't want your closer to have good streaks and bad streaks, because the bad streaks will definitely infuriate you and will blow up otherwise really good statistics. And it was curious before, one thing that when we were talking about the trade and talking about closers a little bit, is we discussed how unorthodox the Yankees bullpen is going to be now, with having so many good pitchers from the right side and their best pitcher from the left side being a guy who is considered their closer. And I've openly wondered, I don't think it's out of the question that David Robertson could close there, could be the closer, and they could use Aroldis Chapman in more of a one-inning role when facing lefties. It at least could be less of a traditional situation than it's been to this point. So I don't know that I would get rid of Robertson right away. If you have roster space, I might keep him for a week and see how it goes. So what kind of drugs you think I'm on there, Darius? You think there's any chance that Robertson closes in New York?
It feels very unlikely to me, just because Chapman is one of the most prominent closers in the league, and I know Robertson's been doing it for a while as well, but I think as disappointing as Chapman has been, I think it would still take a couple of pretty significant blow-ups for him to get removed from the role. And I think Girardi, while he might be willing to use Dylan Betances a bit more creatively, I don't know that I see him also thinking, well, I could use Chapman more creatively too. And yeah, it seems like a bit of a leap to me, but Robertson certainly has the closer tag, so it would be less surprising to me than if they'd say just traded for Conley and then they decided to use him in the closer role instead of Chapman. But I don't see it happening.
What do you think of that freak theory there, Eli? You think there's any chance Robertson closes in New York?
Probably not. I think it does make a lot of sense in my mind, baseball wise. But it just seems like managers never pull that trigger when it comes to closers. They, you know, they all like their traditional roles, and I would love to see it. It makes sense to me, but I don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'd be curious to at least see if this modern trend where that Francona is sort of garnered in for us. If there was any chance, or even on occasion, they would use Robertson, who is having his best season in Chicago for sure, and his best season in quite a while. So he's certainly proven to be quite effective. So anyway, we covered a little bit on closers, which I know is something that that always draws the attention of listeners. They like to hear about the various things going on at the end of the bullpens, even though it seems like such a random thing where all of a sudden a guy like Fernando Rodney can be the best reliever and at one point had the best season in relief pitching history, which is hard for us to imagine. Even though we've seen him shoot so many arrows into the sky over the years, he's certainly been up and down. And so the unpredictability of the closer, while it being nerve-wracking, is something that certainly draws people in and keeps people's attention till the end of the games.
Certainly better than Gorky's Hernandez draws the attention of the listener.
That is true. That was a hell of an idea by me. I mean, if I want to promote myself as somebody who can plan a show, I should probably delete the fact that I ever started a show with Gorky's Hernandez, since I'm pretty sure 3 years from now, even members of his own family won't remember that he played Major League Baseball. So there's something to be said for that. So anyway, I want to thank everyone for listening to this makeshift group, and it was a lot of fun to work with Eli again. Eli, what is your Twitter handle, and have you been active on Twitter these days?
No, I've never really been active, but if my Twitter handle is at EliFWFB, but if you ever have any fantasy baseball, basketball, or football questions, I will 100% get back to you quickly. I have no life whatsoever, so if you want to interact with me, I'm down, but I don't tweet a whole lot.
Well, the other thing I've gotten to do since I haven't been on a show in a long time, and Eli is, I have figured out that his sort of social status has remained the same as portrayed in that little quip that he just gave us right there. Darius, as for yourself, you want to plug anything that you're working on specifically right now, and remind everyone where you can be reached. Darius is a good follow. He is a sort of a person that's always it's always got his nose to the grind and sort of always keeps things out in the middle, never gets too crazy. Darius, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on with you?
So you can find me on Twitter at DariusA64. I did a couple of sort of mid-season projection checkups at Banished to the Pen last week, looking at the teams that have over and underperformed. I kind of like to check in with these things periodically, just to kind of remind myself of what we thought of everybody pre-season and how much things have changed. So I'll be doing that again at the end of the year and reviewing some projection systems. You can also find me over at Batflips and Nerds, which is a UK-based website and podcast. And I did one of those last Friday with some all-star stuff and mid-season awards. And obviously, you can find me at FWFB, and I will have a piece on Tuesday, and I actually haven't decided what it's on yet. Maybe it will now be, does every minor leaguer steal 20 bases, thanks to Eli, but I don't know. So if you've got any suggestions of things you'd like me to look into, feel free to give me a tweet and let me know.
All right. Well, I am Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It. I am pretty active on Twitter, largely because my wife and I have completely different schedules. So while she's sleeping, I look through the Twitter and I go through and answer any questions.
Yeah,
and
that's what you're looking through when she's sleeping.
Exactly. You know it. Because, when I'm done reading Bible scripture, then I look at the Twitter. But regardless of all that, it's been great, you guys, and we appreciate it. Don't forget us on the podcastawards.com. And also don't forget to give us 5-star reviews. I know there's still a system where if you could make a screenshot of your 5-star review and send it to our friend Justin, where you are up for prizes, and a lot of the FWFB stuff and the swag that we've had at FWB is good stuff. So it's something that would be worthwhile. You like us, make sure and give us a good review. We appreciate it. Thanks, everyone out there, for your time. Thank you to Darius, and thanks for Eli being a super sub, as we knew he would be, and we will go from there. We will be back next week with a hopefully less whiny, hopefully not sunburned, Justin Mason, and we go from there. Thanks a lot.